Chapter 8 New Acquaintances Petrov. Time passed, and little by little I accustomed myself to my new life. The scenes I witnessed day by day no longer afflicted me so keenly. In a word, the prison, its inhabitants, and its manners left me indifferent. To grow completely reconciled to the life was impossible, but I had to accept it as an inevitable fact. I had thrown off my earlier anxiety. I no longer wandered about the prison like a lost soul, and no longer allowed myself to be obsessed with worry. The ill-mannered curiosity of the convicts had somewhat abated, and I was no longer looked upon with that affectation of insolence previously displayed. They were no longer interested in me, and I was very glad of it. I began to feel at home in the barrack. I knew where to lie down and sleep at night. I gradually became accustomed to things, the very idea of which would formerly have repelled me. I went regularly every week to have my head shaved. We were called every Saturday, one after another, to the guardhouse, where the regimental barbers lathered our skulls with cold water and soap, and then scraped us with their saw-like razors. The bare memory of this torture makes me shudder. However, I soon discovered a remedy, for Akim Akimitch introduced me to a prisoner in the military section who, for one kopeck, shaved his customers with his own razor. It was his trade. Many of the prisoners went to him merely to avoid the military barbers, though the latter were not men of weak nerves. Our barber was known as the Governor. Why, I cannot say, for so far as I could see, he bore no resemblance whatever to any such official. As I write these lines, I can see him clearly with his thin, drawn face. He was a tall fellow, silent, rather stupid, and entirely absorbed in his business. He was never to be seen without a strop, upon which, day and night, he sharpened a razor, which was also in admirable condition. He had certainly made this work the supreme object of his life. He was really happy when his razor was quite sharp and his services in demand. His lather was always warm, and he had a very light hand, a hand of velvet. He was proud of his skill, and used to take his kopeck with an air of nonchalance. One might have thought that he worked for love of his art and not for material gain. Once F. was severely reprimanded by the prison governor because he had the misfortune to use the word governor when referring to the barber who shaved him. The governor was in a violent rage.
"Blackguard!" he shouted. "Don't you know who is the governor?"
And according to his habit, he shook F. violently.
"The idea of calling a low-down convict governor in my presence!"
From the first day of my imprisonment, I began to dream of my release. My favourite occupation was to count the thousands and thousands of times, in a thousand different ways, the number of days that I had still to spend in prison. To regain my freedom, that was my one ambition, as I am sure it is of every man deprived of his liberty. I cannot affirm that every convict entertained the same degree of hope, but their sanguine disposition often surprised me. Hope in a prisoner differs essentially from that enjoyed by a free man. The latter may desire to improve his condition or to succeed in some enterprise which he has undertaken, but meanwhile he goes about his business and is swept away in the whirlwind of daily life. It is very different with a convict under life sentence. He, too, may be said to live, but having been condemned to an indefinite term, he takes a more indefinite view of his situation than does one who knows how many years he has to serve. The man condemned to a comparatively short period feels that he is temporarily away from home. He considers himself, so to speak, as on a visit. He regards the 20 years of his punishment as 2 years at most. He is sure that at 50, when he has finished his sentence, he will be as young and lively as at 35. "I have time before me," he thinks, and strives obstinately to dispel discouraging thoughts. Even a man condemned for life believes that some day an order may arrive from St. Petersburg. transport so-and-so to the mines at Nerchinsk and fix a term for his detention. That would be grand. First, because it takes 6 months to get to Nerchinsk, and life on the road is 100 times preferable to the prison. He will serve his time at Nerchinsk, and then... More than one grey-haired old man speculates in this way. At Tobolsk, I saw men fastened to the wall at the bedside by a chain about 2 yards long. That is the punishment for serious crime committed on the way to Siberia. They are kept chained up for 5 or even 10 years. They are nearly all brigands. I saw only one who looked like a man of good breeding. He had been in some branch of the civil service and spoke softly with a lisp. His smile was sweet but sickly. He showed us his chain and pointed out the most convenient way of lying down. He must have been a pleasant fellow. All these wretches are perfectly well behaved. They all seem satisfied, and yet they are eaten up with desire to finish their period in chains. Why, it will be asked? Simply because they will then leave their low, damp, stifling cells for the prison courtyard. But they will never be released from prison. They are aware that those who have once been chained up will never regain their freedom and will die in irons. They know all this, and yet they look forward anxiously to the day when they are no longer chained. Without that hope, they could never remain 5 or 6 years fastened to a wall without dying or going mad. I soon understood that work alone could save me, by fortifying my bodily health, whereas incessant restlessness of mind, nervous irritation, and the close air of the barrack would ruin it completely. I should leave prison vigorous and resilient. I did not deceive myself. Work and movement were invaluable. I was horrified to see one of my comrades melt away like a piece of wax. At the beginning of my sentence he was young, handsome, and full of vigour. Yet, when he left, his health was ruined, and his legs could no longer support him. His chest, too, was oppressed by asthma. "No," I said to myself as I watched him. "I wish to live, and I will live." My love of work exposed me at first to the contempt and bitter sarcasm of my comrades, but I paid no attention to them, and went with a light heart to every task. Sometimes, for instance, I was ordered to calcine and pound alabaster. This work, the first I was given, is easy. The engineers did their utmost not to overtax a gentleman. It was not indulgence, but simple justice. It would have been ridiculous to expect the same work from a labourer as from a man whose strength was less by half and who had never worked with his hands. But this never meant that we were spoilt, for the leniency was unofficial and we were strictly supervised. As really heavy work was by no means uncommon, it often happened that the task was beyond the strength of a gentleman, who thus suffered twice as much as his comrades. Generally, 3 or 4 men were sent to pound the alabaster, and old, feeble men were nearly always chosen. We were of the latter class. A skilled workman accompanied us, and for several years he was always the same one, Almazov. He was stern, already advanced in years, sunburnt and very thin, by no means communicative, moreover, and difficult to get on with. He despised us profoundly, but was of such a reserved disposition that he never broke into open abuse. The shed in which we calcined the alabaster was built on a sloping and deserted bank of the river. On a foggy winter's day, the view on the river and far beyond the opposite bank was gloomy. There was something heartrending in this dull, naked landscape, but it was still more depressing when a brilliant sun shone above the boundless white plain. How one would have liked to fly away beyond this steppe, which, beginning on the opposite shore, stretched like a huge tablecloth for 1,500 versts to the south. Almazov went to work silently, with a disagreeable air. We were ashamed not to be able to help him more effectually, but he managed to do his work without our assistance, and seemed to wish us to understand that we were unfair towards him, and that we ought to repent our uselessness. Our work was to heat the oven for calcining the alabaster which we had gathered into heaps. Next day, when the alabaster was fully calcined, we turned it out. Each man filled a box with the stuff, which he then proceeded to crush. It was not an unpleasant job. The fragile stone soon became a brilliant white dust. We brandished our heavy hammers and dealt such formidable blows that we admired our own strength. When we were tired, we felt lighter. Our cheeks were red. The blood circulated more rapidly in our veins. Almazov would then look at us in a condescending manner, as he would have at little children. He smoked his pipe with an indulgent air, unable, however, to prevent himself from grumbling. He never opened his mouth except to complain. He was the same with everyone. At bottom, I believe, he was a kindly soul. I had another job. It consisted in working the lathe wheel. This wheel was large and heavy. Great strength was necessary to make it revolve, especially when the fellows in the engineering shop were making the balustrade of a staircase or the foot of a large table from a length of tree trunk. No one man could have done the work alone. B, a gentleman, and I were regularly appointed to this task during several years. B, though still young, was weak but very friendly. He had been sent to prison a year before me, with two companions who were also of noble birth. One of them, an old man, used to pray day and night and was greatly respected for it. He died in prison. The other was quite a young fellow, fresh-coloured, strong and courageous. He had carried his companion B for several hundred versts, when, at the end of the first half-stage, he collapsed through fatigue. Their mutual love was worth seeing. B was a perfectly well-bred man, of noble and generous disposition, but spoiled and irritated by illness. We used to turn the wheel well together, and the work interested us. Indeed, I found the exercise most beneficial. I was, moreover, very fond of shovelling away the snow, which we generally did after the frequent gales of the winter. When a hurricane had been raging for an entire day, more than one house would be covered to the windows, if not completely buried. The wind died down, the sun reappeared, and we were ordered to dig out the buildings from the snowdrifts. We were told off in large groups, which sometimes consisted of the entire prison population. Each man received a shovel and had to move a given quantity of snow, which sometimes appeared an impossible task, but we all set to work with a good will. The light, powdery snow had not yet congealed and was frozen only on the surface. We removed it in enormous shovelfuls and scattered it over a wider area. In the air, the snow dust was as brilliant as diamonds. The shovel sank easily into the white, glittering mass. The convicts almost always appeared happy at this work, animated by exercise and the cold, wintry air. Everyone felt himself in better spirits. Laughter and jokes were heard. Snowballs were exchanged. After a time, this excited the indignation of the serious-minded convicts, who liked neither laughter nor gaiety, and the performance was generally concluded in showers of abuse. Little by little, my circle increased, although I never intentionally made new acquaintances. I was always restless, morose, and mistrustful, but one seemed to make friends involuntarily. The first who came to visit me was a man named Petrov. I purposely say visit because he belonged to the special division, which was housed at the opposite end of the courtyard. It seemed as if no understanding could exist between us, for we had nothing in common. Nevertheless, during the early days of my imprisonment, Petrov thought it his duty to call on me nearly every day, or at least to stop me at the rear of our barrack, where, after a day's work, I used to stroll as far as possible from the eyes of men. His persistence was disagreeable to me, but he managed so well that his visits became at last a pleasing diversion, although he was by no means of a communicative disposition. He was short, strongly built, agile and skilful. He had quite a pleasing voice, high cheekbones, a bold look, and white, regular teeth. He always had a quid of tobacco in his mouth, between the lower lip and the gums. Many of the convicts had the habit of chewing. He seemed to me younger than he really was, for although 40 years of age, he looked no more than 30. He addressed me without ceremony, and behaved with civility and attention as though we were on an equal footing. If, for instance, he saw that I wished to be alone, he would talk to me for about 2 minutes and then go away. He thanked me, moreover, each time for my kindness in conversing with him, a thing he never did to anyone else. I must add that his relationship with me remained unaltered during the first period of my story and for several years afterwards, that they never became more intimate, although he was in fact my friend. I could never properly understand what he expected from my society, nor why he came every day to see me. He sometimes robbed me, but it was almost an involuntary act. He never came to me to borrow money, so that what attracted him was not personal interest. It seemed to me, I know not why, that this man was not a fellow convict, but lived some distance away in the town. It was as if he had come to the prison by chance in search of news, to inquire after me, in fact, to see how I was getting on. He was always in a hurry, as though he had momentarily left someone who was waiting for him, or as if he had left his business for an hour or so. And yet he never hurried himself. He wore a fixed look, with a slight air of levity and irony. He had a habit of gazing into the distance high above the objects nearer at hand, as though he were trying to get a glimpse of something behind the person to whom he was talking. He always seemed absent-minded. I sometimes asked myself where he went when he left me, and where he could be so anxiously expected. He would simply go with a light step to one of the barracks or to the kitchen, sit down and listen to the conversation. He would listen attentively, join in with eagerness, and then suddenly fall silent. But whether he spoke or kept silent, one seemed always to discern in his countenance that he had business somewhere else, and that someone was waiting for him in the neighbouring town. The most astonishing was that he never had any business, apart, of course, from the hard labour assigned to him. He knew no trade, and had scarcely ever any money. But that did not seem to upset him. Why did he speak to me? His conversation was as strange as he himself was singular. When he noticed me walking alone behind the barrack, he stopped and turned towards me. He walked very fast, and when I turned, he was suddenly on his heel. He approached me at a walking pace, but so quickly that he seemed to be running. "Good evening." "Good evening. I'm not disturbing you." "No. I want to ask you something about Napoleon. Is he any relation of the one who invaded Russia in 1812?" Petrov was a soldier's son, and knew how to read and write. "Of course he is. People say he is president. How president, and of what?" His questions were always rapid and abrupt, as though he required an immediate answer. I explained Napoleon's position, and added that he might become emperor. "How will that be?" I explained it to him as well as I could. Petrov listened with attention. He understood perfectly all I told him, and then, leaning towards me, said, "Can you tell me, Alexander Petrovich, if there are really monkeys that have hands instead of feet, and are as tall as men?"
"Yes."
"What are they like?" And I described them to him, and told him what I knew on the subject. "And where do they live?"
"In warm climates. There are some to be found on the island of Sumatra."
"Is that in America? I have heard that people there walk with their heads downwards."
"No, no, you are thinking of the Antipodes."
I explained to him as well as I could what America was and what the Antipodes. He listened to me as attentively as if the question of the Antipodes alone had caused him to approach me.
"I see.
Now, I read last year the story of the Countess de la Valliere. Agreviev borrowed the book from the adjutant. Is it truth or fiction? It's by Dumas.
Fiction, of course.
Really? Well, goodbye. I'm much obliged to you.
And he disappeared.
The above may be taken as a fair specimen of our conversation.
I made inquiries about Petrov.
M. decided he ought to speak to me on the subject when he learned what an acquaintance I had made. He told me that many convicts had excited his horror on their arrival, but not one of them, not even Gazin, had made upon him so bad an impression as had this fellow Petrov.
"He is the most determined and unreliable villain in the place," said M. "He's capable of anything. Nothing can withstand his whims. He'll assassinate you if the fancy takes him, without hesitation and without the least remorse. I often think he is not in his right senses." This declaration was most interesting, but M. was never able to tell me why he entertained so low an opinion of Petrov. Strangely enough, I used to see and talk with this man almost every day for years. He was always my sincere friend, though I could not at the time tell why, and during all that time he lived very quietly and did nothing extraordinary. And yet I feel sure that M. was right, that Petrov may, after all, have been a violent character and the most difficult of any of the convicts to restrain. I do not know why I should believe that, but Petrov was the man who, when called upon to receive his punishment, had tried to kill the governor. I have already explained how the governor was saved as by a miracle, having left a moment before the sentence was carried out. Once, when he was still a soldier, before his arrival at the prison, his colonel had struck him on parade. He had no doubt often been beaten before, but that day he was in no humour to endure an insult in broad daylight in front of the whole battalion drawn up in line. He killed the colonel. I do not know all the details of the story, for he never told it to me himself. It must be understood, however, that these outbursts occurred only when nature within him spoke too loudly, and such occasions were rare. As a rule, he was serious and even quiet. His strong, ardent passions had not burned out, but smouldered like burning coals beneath ashes. I never noticed that he was vain or given to bragging like so many other convicts. He scarcely ever quarrelled, but he was friendly towards very few, except perhaps Sirotkin, and then only when he had need of him. One day, however, I saw him thoroughly roused. Someone had offended him by refusing a request. He was arguing the point with a tall convict, as vigorous as an athlete named Vasily Antonov, who was known for his nagging, spiteful disposition. But this man belonged to the class of civil convicts, and was certainly no coward. They shouted at one another for some time, and I thought the quarrel would finish, like so many others of the same kind, by simple exchange of abuse. As it was, the affair took an unexpected turn. Petrov suddenly turned pale. His lips trembled and turned blue. His respiration became difficult. He got up, and slowly, very slowly, with imperceptible steps, he liked to walk about with his feet naked, approached Antonov. The shouting at once gave place to deathly silence. A passing fly might have been heard, and everyone waited anxiously to see what happened. Antonov pointed to his adversary. His face was no longer human. I was unable to endure the scene and left the room. I was certain that before I reached the staircase I would hear the shrieks of a dying man, but nothing of the kind took place. Before Petrov could lay hands on him, Antonov threw him the object which had caused the quarrel, a miserable rag, a worn-out piece of lining. Later, of course, Antonov made a point of abusing Petrov, but rather as a matter of honour, from a sense of duty, in order to show that he had not really been afraid. Petrov, however, paid no attention to his insults and did not reply. He had won the day, and insults went by almost unnoticed. He was glad to have obtained his rag.
A quarter of an hour later he was strolling leisurely about the barracks, looking for some group whose conversation might perhaps gratify his curiosity. Everything seemed to interest him, and yet he appeared to be indifferent to all he heard. He might have been compared to a labourer, one of those fellows who are such devils for work, but who is for the moment idle, and therefore condescends to spend a little while playing with his children. I could never understand why he stayed in prison, why he did not escape. He would not have hesitated to run for it had he really wished to do so. Reason has no power over men like Petrov when they take the bit between their teeth. If they desire something, they allow no object to stand in their way. I am certain that he would have been sufficiently clever to escape, that he could have deceived everyone, and remained for a time without food, hidden in the forest or a patch of bulrushes. But the idea had evidently not occurred to him. I never observed him to have much judgment or common sense. Men like him are born with one idea, which, without their being aware of it, pursues them all their lives. They wander about until they spy some object which excites their cupidity, and are then prepared to risk their heads. I was sometimes astonished that a man who had assassinated his colonel for striking him was ready to bow down before the rods, for Petrov was regularly flogged for smuggling vodka into prison. Like all those with no definite occupation, he traded in spirits, and, if caught, admitted himself in the wrong and took a flogging as though he welcomed punishment. Otherwise, he would have died rather than submit. More than once I was surprised to catch him robbing me in spite of his affection for me, but so it happened from time to time. On one occasion, for instance, he stole my Bible, which I had asked him to restore to its place. He had only a few yards to go, but on the way he met a purchaser to whom he sold the book, and immediately spent the money on vodka. He probably felt a violent craving for drink that day, for when he desired something he had to have it. A man like Petrov will commit murder for 25 kopecks simply in order to buy himself a pint of vodka. Yet on other occasions he will despise hundreds and thousands of rubles. He confessed his theft the same evening, nonchalantly, without a trace of remorse or embarrassment, as if he were relating some commonplace incident. I did my best to reprove him as he deserved, for I was annoyed at the loss of my Bible. He listened attentively, agreed that the Bible was a very useful book, and sincerely regretted that I no longer had it. But not for one moment was he sorry for having stolen it. He looked at me with such assurance that I left off scolding. He bore my reproaches because he believed I could not do otherwise. He knew he deserved to be punished for his act, and consequently presumed that it was my duty to reprimand him in order to vent my feelings and to console myself for the loss. But deep down in his heart he considered the whole thing nonsense, something to which an intelligent man would be ashamed to descend. I even believe that he regarded me as a little child who does not yet understand the simplest things in the world. If I spoke to him of anything except books and learning, he would answer me, but only from politeness and in laconic phrases. I wondered what made him question me so much on the subject of books, and watched him closely during our conversation in order to assure myself that he was not laughing at me. But no, he listened gravely, and with an attention which was genuine, if not always sustained, a fact which sometimes irritated me. However, the questions he asked were clear and precise, and he seemed always anxious for my reply. He had made up his mind once for all that it was useless speaking to me about anything except books, apart from which I knew nothing. I am certain, and indeed was often surprised, that he was attached to me. But he looked upon me as a child, or at least as not yet quite grown up. He felt towards me that sort of compassion which the stronger always feels for the weaker. He took me for, I really don't know what. Although this compassion did not prevent him from robbing me, I am sure that even while he did so, he felt sorry for me. "What a strange fellow," he must have told himself as he laid hands on my property. He doesn't even know how to take care of his own belongings. That, I think, is why he liked me. One day he suddenly remarked, "You're too good-natured. You're so simple that one cannot help pitying you." And a moment later he added, "Don't be offended at what I said just now, Alexander Petrovich. I didn't mean it like that." Fellows like Petrov often express themselves forcibly when they are upset or excited. At such times they come, as it were, to life, though ordinarily they are men of few words. They could never incite a plan or rebellion, but they are well fitted to carry out another's order. They act deliberately and hurl themselves against an obstacle without thought or trace of fear. All will follow them to the foot of the wall, where, however, they generally lay down their lives. I do not think Petrov can have, however, met any but a violent end. If he is still alive, it only means that he has never yet been in the neighbourhood of death. But who knows? He may perhaps die in extreme old age, quite quietly, after having wandered aimlessly through life. Yes, I still believe M was right, and that Petrov was the most determined man in the whole of that prison.